Alrighty, good morning, and 7:39 now. It is time for our chat with Holly Miner from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Good morning, Holly. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey, it's good to have you on here, and always enjoy talking with you, and enjoying helping Doug out there with his ham radio set up, too. You know, we've been having some good times with that.
Yep.
So it's very excellent. So, first of all, I did want to ask you, I know that you've been having your adult cooking class. You had that,
yes.
Last week, I think?
Yes.
So yes. How have those been going?
Those have been going really well. We had a great group of people participate in that. We meet on Thursday evenings from 6 to 7:30, and we did a chopped salad competition this last week. So there were all sorts of salad ingredients, and they got to pick and choose what they wanted in their salads, and then they prepared those salads, and we talked about them afterwards. And it was just a really fun group, and everybody got an apron for coming, and they get to wear that the rest of the time. So we meet every other Thursday, there is a registration that needs to be done. I do have some spaces available. I had some people that didn't show up last week, so if we have that happen again, I will have some spaces available. So that is in Neodesha. And if you're interested in that, you can give me a call at 620-331-2690.
Excellent. Well, very good. Well, we always, having that chance to have the cooking class, you can learn some new techniques and that sort of thing. But, you know, for those who can attend, I know that you wanted to share a little bit of meal prep tip today, right?
Yes. So we're going to be talking about meal preparation. What are some of the things that you should think about as you're getting ready to prepare your meals? And, with the increase in the food prices and gasoline being so high right now, it's really important that we are able to save some money by doing some planning ahead of time and then just making one trip to the grocery store every week. So we do want to plan each week out. So think about your main dish first and figure out what that's going to be, and then add your side dishes into that. And then go through your pantry and see what you have in your pantry. Look for those items in there that might help you decide what that main dish could be or what some of those side dishes could be. And then plan your meals for the week around that. Once you have that menu set, then make yourself a shopping list. And you can also look at sale flyers, or you can join reward programs or do coupon shopping or coupon clipping online. And there's a lot of new apps that are out that do coupons online. And so you can have all of those things prepared and ready before you go to the grocery store. So when you get to the grocery store, you can focus on finding those foods on your list.
Oh, that is good. I mean, I know there's even some of the major retailers and that sort of thing have an app where, you know, you'll be able to do that digital clipping or whatever. Or, you know, some places on like Saturday, you get 5 off 25 or, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. They'll have some sort of deal going when, hey, if you can wait until Saturday and you know you're going to spend more than $25 anyway, that's going to be a great deal on that.
That's right. Those are great options. And some of those privately owned or smaller chains have those options available to you, and it's great to be able to take advantage of those. And then, you know, when you get done shopping, you want to save your receipt, and that'll help you to figure out how much money you have left in your budget for if you need to stop and pick something else up or if something else happens. I would suggest that when you are doing your grocery shopping, that you plan for so many meals, and then know that you have an extra meal if you need it, but also think about, okay, we have ball games going on. We're not going to be home that night. We're going to have to go out to eat that night. So what can you do to compensate for the amount of money that you're going to spend going out to eat versus staying home and preparing it at home? Something else to consider is when you're planning your menu, think about, okay, I have half a pepper I'm going to use in my Sloppy Joes. What am I going to do with that other half of the pepper? And so the food doesn't go to waste. You can say, okay, well, I'm going to make fajitas. So I'm going to use the rest of that pepper in fajitas. And there you have your two main dishes. They're both using peppers, and you're able to eliminate some of that food waste. And that's something else that a lot of times we have an idea of what we're going to plan for our menu, but then we don't think about, oh, I'm only going to use a half an onion, or, you know, and I can freeze an onion, I can freeze a pepper, I can't freeze lettuce, you know, it's not going to be very good when it comes, when you thaw it out.
No.
But, you know, what are some other ways, and that's why it's important also to know what's in your pantry or what's in your freezer. So you're using those things up in a reasonable amount of time so they're still fresh and at their best nutritional value.
Sure. Well, and I know, too, that sometimes, you know, we can get away with maybe buying some less expensive cuts of meat if they're prepared right. You know, if you have to take a little extra time and that sort of thing, you can really make them taste great just if you put that little extra effort in.
That's right. You know, there's all sorts of ways to prepare things. And if you have a tougher cut of meat, preparing it in a way where you're not eliminating any of the moisture out of it. So maybe you stick it in the crock pot with some juices, or you, you know, braise it and then stick it in the oven, but, you know, tent it and put some juice in there with it. And, you know, there's different ways to prepare things. Grilling, marinating it as you're grilling, that's always a great way to keep the moisture in the food as well. So there's all sorts of little tricks and things that you can do when you're preparing your food.
No, that is a good reminder there. So what else on meal prep should we know about here?
Yeah,
today?
So you're all ready to go to the grocery store now. So when you get to the grocery store, what are some things that you consider even before you go to the grocery store? So you always want to go to the grocery store after you've eaten a meal.
Yes.
you want to make sure that you're full when you go to the grocery store, and that will eliminate some of that impulse buying that we all have. And if you can go by yourself, that's going to eliminate somebody else saying, oh, well, let's get this, and getting off track from what you have on your menu and on your grocery list. And the other thing is to go at a time where you can, where you don't feel rushed, where you can get what you need, and you can really do some comparison shopping. So looking at that brand name item versus a store brand, and is there a cost savings there? Sometimes they're up to a dollar difference, depending on what it is. And if it's something that you're going to put into a casserole or into the crock pot as a component of a recipe and not an item by itself, you can get away with some of those less expensive brands.
And we've all been there where, you know, you're in an aisle and you're trying to figure out something. Someone's coming up behind you and you're like, oh, you know, almost panic because you want to, like, get out of their way, of course. And
yeah.
And you're just, okay, well, I'll just grab this.
That's right.
And the other thing, I don't know about you, Holly, but I feel like when I walk into a grocery store, it's like they're spraying something in the air. It makes me, like, give amnesia real quick because I kind of forget why I'm there. I'm like, what am I doing here? And then you start like, oh, I'm on that, you know?
Yeah.
So you just, I feel like that happens every time I walk in a store. I forget why I'm there.
Right. Somebody asked me the other day, well, what do you do if there's an item on sale that's not on your grocery list?
Mm.
So, you know, that's a great question. I think about that food item that's on sale. Is it something that I normally use? You know, we all have our set favorite dishes that we like to make. And if it's an item that's in one of those dishes, then I would say go ahead and get it while it's on sale. And you can put it in your pantry, and when you're looking at your menu for the next week, you can remember, oh yeah, I've got that in my pantry, I can use that. And you've purchased it while it's on sale, so you've saved some money. Sometimes buying in bulk is good, depending on what it is. Again, if it's one of those items that you use a lot of, I use a lot of cream of mushroom soup or cream of chicken soup when I'm making casseroles and things like that, or side dishes. And those are great things to have and would be something that I would buy in bulk.
Sure. No, it makes sense. That's a definite good one. So anything else that we should think about kind of like while we're in the grocery store and that sort of thing?
Yeah. So it is summertime now. So there's a lot of produce being that's in season right now. And so when you're shopping, think about what foods are in season. You know, in February, I think about blood oranges, or a lot of citrus fruit is coming in season in February. So it in March, and so it's a little bit less expensive then to purchase those things. Now we have watermelon and tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers and all of those kinds of things, which are great to have. And you can purchase those fresh now for a little bit less money than you might be able to during other times of the year. And then also think about the frozen food section. So maybe it's not an item that's in season, but you can purchase it frozen, less expensive than you can purchase it fresh. And so that's always a good option as well. And then if you purchase something fresh and you're not going to use it all, can it be frozen and used later? And, you know, as a small family, sometimes you purchase something and it only comes in one size and you're only going to eat half of it. And by the time you would want to have it again a couple days later, it might be spoiled, especially if it's a fresh produce. And so can that be frozen? And we have information in our office about freezing foods and that kind of thing. The other thing is to think about is, can it be dried? And so, you know, you might dry onions or you might dry tomatoes, and those would be great going back into stews. I've dried peppers before, and those are great going back into a soup or a stew. And so think about those kinds of things as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, my folks have now, I think, two dehydrators for when you get, especially the apple season, because we always do those, we'll dry apples. And I mean, we'll have those going all 24/7, it seems like, and with the apple core peeler slicer thing. And I mean, it's great because you can get apples for such good prices. And I mean, you should see how much they charge for like dried apples in the store. It's just crazy.
It is
crazy. So you do it yourself for like the price of a dehydrator, you quickly offset that.
Yes. And they're great for snacks. You know, you could take them to work. You could take them on the way to a ball game. You could have them at a ball game. And it's not like you're carrying this great big apple around, but you're carrying this bag of small pieces that are easily consumable, and you don't have to worry about dropping them on the ground, or, you know, you can not be sticky and all those kinds of things too. Apples and bananas, pineapple's another good one. Mm-hmm. That's a fruit that you can dry, and it dries pretty well. So, that's a great point to consider as well.
Sure. So anything else as far as, kind of this prep and that sort of thing that we might want to be thinking about?
Yeah. So when you get to the checkout line, then you want to make sure that you are watching that if you did purchase things that were on sale, that you are getting that sale price at the register. I always feel like it's a bonus day when I see something that wasn't given at the sale price, and I can say, hey, that was on sale.
Yep, yep.
And you know, it's kind of a good memory tool too, to make you keep your mind working, to try to remember, especially when you have a basket full of things. Oh, what was the price of that? Is that the correct price? So it's a good little memory or brain teaser kind of activity as well.
You know, I always made fun of my parents a little bit for standing up there at the register and looking at the receipt afterwards, but now I'm in the same boat, and I catch there are mistakes that are made yes. You know, with some frequency, just because of, you know, sales that maybe, you know, didn't get put into the system or that sort of thing. So it does definitely happen, or just price tags that maybe were wrong. So I always do try to, you know, think about how, you know, what the price was, or you know, maybe a scale problem or that sort of thing. So it's always good to double check all of that.
Yeah. And then remember your coupons when you get up there. You know, a lot of times when I get to the checkout, I'm so excited to be done shopping and be ready to go home. And then it's like, oh yeah, I have this coupon, and I forget to give it to them. Or sometimes you'll be shopping and there'll be a box or something that has a coupon on it, and when you get to the checkout, they just put everything into the bag.
Yep.
and don't catch that coupon that's actually on that box or package. And so, you know, make sure that you don't check out at the checkout stand, that you're still watching and making sure that you're getting the sales.
Exactly. So you got done with the store here, we get home, what else should we do from there?
Well, we want to think about what we're purchasing before we go to the store.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Are we purchasing items that are cold?
Mm-hmm.
And when it's hot like this, we want to make sure that we take a cooler or maybe a insulated bag along that we can put that cold stuff in. I have a sleeping bag in the back of my car that's all laid out, and I usually throw the cold food in and throw that over the top of the cold food to kind of insulate it on the way home. If you're driving more than an hour from your grocery store, then you probably should have a cooler to make sure you're keeping that food cold. That becomes a food safety thing, and then that's a whole nother topic.
Oh yeah, no, but, yeah, exactly. But no, especially you know, maybe some of our listeners who might live a ways from a grocery store, or maybe they're going to one of the bigger box stores for you know some discount savings that isn't around here. Maybe they have to go down to Tulsa or something.
Yes.
So yeah, that's definitely a good idea if you're going to have a big shopping trip like that.
And I always try to keep an insulated bag in my car all the time. And then if I get somewhere and I see a sale going on, I can take advantage of it by having that bag in there if there's cold items available. Even, you know, I drive about a half an hour to get to a grocery store. Even having just that insulated bag to put your milk in,
mm-hmm.
you know, it keeps it cold longer. And, I think it helps the less, that you time and temperature abuse a food, where you're leaving it out of refrigeration, for a longer amount of time, then I think the less spoilage and the longer the food lasts.
Sure.
So it's a food quality as well as a food safety issue.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Well, as we get closer here to our end of this segment, Holly, what else should we know about this topic here?
Let's see. Going to the store by yourself, I said that.
Yep.
And, mm-hmm. and leaving children home, if at all possible, if you can have a spouse watch your children while you're doing your grocery shopping or do your grocery shopping on the way to pick them up from daycare. You know, that eliminates a lot of those little episodes that you might see in the grocery store. And it also allows you to be able to really concentrate on your shopping. So, and then I guess when you get home, make sure that you keep that receipt and then add that and then just double check to make sure everything that you purchased was charged. It was charged once and it was charged at the correct amount.
Sure. No, that's a great point because, you know, those little mistakes do happen. And sometimes, I mean, you know, stores are pretty good about when you bring that back to the customer service or whatever, making it right.
Yeah, they are.
So, okay, well, Holly, we do have, I know coming up, Jesse Gilmore will be in, so we'll be chatting with him a little bit, but if people do have questions on any topics related to, you know, food safety, nutrition, that sort of thing, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
They can give our office a call at 620-331-2690, or they can email me at haminer@ksu.edu.
Okay, very good. And I know we've got food preservation time coming up and people are starting to get canning and that sort of thing. So always a good thing to be able to give you a call if they have questions on that. And I know we'll be talking about that here soon.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Holly. That's Holly Miner here from K-State Research and Extension. Coming up, we will have more on the way on KGGF. Back here at 810 on the Mighty 690, we continue our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And before we get Jesse Gilmore here on the line, we have Holly Miner once again with a couple more events that are coming up.
Yeah, so you mentioned food preservation classes, and we have some of those coming up here in July. On the 27th, we have a class in Girard that will start at 5:30. Independence class is August 22nd, and then on August 24th, we're going to Fredonia. And then we're coming back to Independence, and we'll be at the library on August 29th. And then we have a Serve Safe Food Handlers training, which will be July 19th at the Stockyard Restaurant in Fredonia from 3 to 7. And all of those classes do require pre-registration. And if you can give our office a call, we'll get you set up on how to register. And there are spaces still available in all of those classes. So We'd love to have you come and join us, and we're looking forward to offering those sessions.
And so you're going to be going over just basically how to can different types of produce and all that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, we'll focus on the two main canning methods, the pressure canning for low acid foods and the water bath canning for high acid foods, such as jams and jellies and fruits and pickles.
Well, that'll be good, especially as we approach, you know, fair time, and if people want to enter in those general class categories, it's always good to have more entries.
That's right. Give your mom some competition.
Yeah, that's right. She needs it. So Holly, if people do want to sign up, what's the number to do that?
620-331-2690.
Excellent. Well, now we are happy to welcome to the airwaves Mr. Jesse Gilmore. How are you doing, sir?
Doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Good deal. Doing well. So, all right, Jesse, I know you're going to, horticulture agent, of course, going to be talking about some plants and that sort of thing. So what do we need to know here about scouting plants?
Yeah, so I have gotten, obviously, a lot of questions about problems, you know, plants dying or in the process of dying. And scouting is actually the act of going out and finding problems before they become super severe. Obviously, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's how the saying goes. And so if you can go out and start looking for problems, like if you're noticing small changes in your plants, it could be nothing. It could be, you know, environmental response, but it could also be something that's causing damage and could end up being more severe in the long term. One example, and one that I had never really experienced before this year, is known as Kermes scale, K-E-R-M-E-S. We've been seeing this a bit on white oak trees in particular, and it really only is white oak trees. They don't affect reds at all, as far as I can tell, or at least I haven't gotten any calls and I haven't seen them affecting reds out in the wild. But scale is a type of insect that kind of looks like an abnormal growth on a branch, but it is actually a piercing, sucking insect, kind of like aphids. So piercing, sucking insects are insects that insert their mouth parts into the tissue of the plant and basically pull out any liquid that they can reach with their mouth parts. So aphids, when they're piercing and sucking usually the stems of tomato plants, they're trying to get the liquid inside that is transporting sugars up and down the plant to the tissue that needs it. And so that sugar is high energy. That's what the insects are going for. And so that's what scale is going for, too. And this particular species of scale on white oak trees, it only goes out to the very tips of the branches. So on white oak trees that are suffering from scale infestations, you're going to see the leaves on the very tips of the branches die off, but everything else inside on the canopy looks healthy. And that's because there's so much scale usually on these twigs that they are sucking all of the water and nutrients out of the twig before it can get to those leaves, and those leaves basically die of starvation. So while sometimes it can be easy to overlook, like a few leaves dying off in the tree, oftentimes it is worth investigating and getting a closer look at the branches to see if there is something in particular that is causing that issue. Usually when people in the plant industry talk about scouting, they're almost always talking about insects. Sometimes scouting can be environmental damage, like marginal leaf scorch, if you start seeing some kind of discoloration. Sometimes it can be environmental or disease-related, too. If you catch a disease early, that's obviously, you're going to be able to control it better than if you, you know, caught it when it's in the later stages of the disease. So one good example of trying to catch a problem early before it really becomes a problem is squash bugs. Right now we are seeing squash bug eggs starting to hatch. When I was at the Parsons Community Garden on Monday, we actually found some nymphs crawling around on the zucchini and pumpkin plants there. So squash bugs, a lot of people know about them because they are such a ubiquitous pest in our area. But they lay their eggs on the underside of the squash leaves beginning to the middle of June. And so those eggs need to incubate, and then when they hatch, you've got nymphs. The problem with not scouting for squash bugs and waiting until you actually see the bug is that once they get to their adult stage, any insecticide sprays you can use will not be effective on them. And that's usually because of a waxy coating on the outside of their bodies that repels water that the chemical is you know, dissolved in. So squash bugs, once they get to their adult size, usually they're in enough populations to where they will kill off the squash plants entirely if they are allowed to get to adult size. So going out and looking for those eggs before they hatch and removing them from the plant if you can is the best way to, A, keep yourself from suffering a lot of headaches in the future as the squash plants continue to grow, and B, keeping the cost and environmental impact of any pesticide you need to spray lower compared to trying to control them. And obviously, you do have some strategies for keeping insect pests at a minimum if you are growing vegetables. For trees, you're kind of stuck with trees. You're not really going to be able to replace them with something else. If, for example, you have an infestation of scale, you can't do crop rotation with trees like you can with vegetables or with annual plants that you put into your garden. So knowing what kind of insects affect your trees and what kind of insects have affected your trees in the past is a good way to scout for problems. Bagworms are another good example of scouting.
Okay, so you mentioned bagworms, and I think I've seen them now. Like, if we're talking, you know, you'll see something that's floating in midair, like hanging down from a little thread, and there's a little worm coming out of it. I've seen them hatching, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they actually hatched around the beginning of June, and when they hatch, they are very, very tiny, only about a quarter of an inch long. So a lot of times when we talk about spraying for pests, we usually don't recommend spraying unless you're actively seeing the pest, because spraying when you don't have a pest present can just be more of an environmental negative than a positive. Bagworms are the one exception where we recommend spraying before you actually see them. And obviously, if you are scouting for them really early, then you might be able to find them when they are present. But it takes a very close look at your evergreens in order to see them present. But if you do have bagworms right now, this is another insect that is kind of hard to control once you have them present and once they've spun their bag. Not a ton of bugs will have a like hard time limit on the period where you can control them or not. Bagworms and squash bugs are two of the exceptions. So if you're having problems now with bagworms, it's going to take a specific type of chemical called spinosad. And spinosad works a little differently from contact insecticides. The majority of chemicals that you can spray to kill bugs are going to be contact. They have to physically touch the bug that they are trying to kill while the chemical, while the water that the chemical is in is still present. So the bug physically has to be there when you spray. Spinosad is a little different in that it will leave a residue on what you spray it on, and anything that goes to eat the leaf tissue on that plant will ingest the chemical and then die. So you've got your contact insecticides, you've got your residue insecticides, and then you've got your systemic insecticides. And usually systemic insecticides are going to be sufficient for most bug problems, not bagworms, unfortunately. Of course, the one thing that we need it to control the most of is the one thing that it doesn't control. But systemic insecticides you mix with water, like pretty much any other insecticide, but you pour the water at the base of the plant. Usually these are going to be trees that are economically unfeasible to spray the entirety of, but still have bug problems. This is actually what we recommend for controlling the scale issue on oak trees is a systemic insecticide drench. Usually that chemical is going to be imidacloprid, I'm pretty sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but if they wanted people to pronounce chemical names correctly, they would make them shorter.
Right.
but you mix it with water. You pour it at the base of the tree. The tree takes it around a month to pull the chemical up with the water. But once the chemical is present in the tissue, it gets moved throughout the entire plant tissue. And then anything that goes to ingest plant tissue or plant water, like the xylem fluid in that is going out to the leaves and carrying these sugars, it will also ingest the chemical and it will die. And imidacloprid, in general, is going to be a lot safer for things like bees, for example, when compared to contact insecticides. Now, you do want to carefully consider whether or not your tree attracts pollinators, because that chemical will be present in the nectar. So if you are having a more ornamental tree, like a crabapple or a Bradford pear, for example, that does have those attractive flowers that will attract pollinators, you might want to think twice about using a systemic insecticide like that. Because that will be present in the nectar that the tree produces. But if you are having a plant like an oak tree that does not have very showy flowers, I believe most oak trees are going to have catkins that do not attract like bees and other pollinators like that, then that would be safe to use imidacloprid or another systemic insecticide on.
Hey, wait. I know we've had a lot of words today, but yeah, catkins are, I just learned about actually, you know, what those are.
Yeah, catkins are not like normal flowers. Most of the time when you see catkins, those are actually going to be wind pollinated because they hang down and they hold their pollen very loosely compared to other flowering plants that attract pollinators with nectar. So they don't have really any nectar in the flowers, which means they are not attractive to animal and insect pollinators.
So, like, pecans have catkins. Any that I'm aware of, that like that's where I saw them. I think, right?
Right. There's a lot of different catkin species, and sometimes you'd find catkins where you're not expecting them. But yeah, catkins—they are responsible for a lot of pollen allergies, too, because they hold on to their pollen so loosely, and because they need that wind. A lot of them are wind pollinated, so the pollen will carry usually to your sinuses and then cause some congestion and sneezing and things like that. So scouting again, if you can catch the problem early, that's always best. And, you know, if you have any questions about something you think might be a problem, it's always worth calling in to ask. You know, you can send me photos to my cell phone or to my email address, or you can bring a plant in if you're seeing things you might think are problems. Sometimes you won't be able to catch problems before they start affecting your plant's health. And at that point, you're going to need to determine, whether the plant is in serious danger, and B, what your acceptable level of damage is before trying to control it. And that's going to rely on really two things. The first is what type of plant you're growing. Obviously, an ornamental plant, the damage threshold before controlling the problem becomes required is going to be a lot lower for an ornamental plant because it's there for its look. And so any damage or disease or environmental problem is going to immediately detract from its purpose. Whereas with more shade trees that are there mostly for shade and not for look, you know, like your elms, your oaks, things like that, or for vegetables and fruit, the damage is not always going to immediately detract from, you know, food production or from shade. So my example for this is I was working at an urban farm in Kansas City campus. And I was responsible for scouting for pests and for assessing when we needed to go out and spray for pests. And the Colorado potato beetle population that year was pretty bad. But what I found when I was out scouting is that they emerged pretty late from the soil and from their overwintering. So by the time that they were doing damage to the potato plant, most of the size of the potatoes had already been set. So they were feeding on the above ground parts of the potato, you know, the leaves and the stem, but they weren't feeding on the part that we were selling, which was obviously the tubers. And the damage they were doing to the leaves and the stem were so late that they were not impacting the yield of the potato plant at all. And because we were an organic farm, we had to use organic control methods if we were ever going to spray for pests. So that became, because we weren't having any negative drawback to the beetles being there, and because control would be so expensive otherwise, we determined that the damage was not severe enough on the plant to warrant control. And we just basically let them do their thing on the potato plants that year. And then we rotated, well, I didn't because I wasn't there anymore, but they rotated the potatoes around the field to keep the population from getting too established in one particular part of the farm. So there are some cultural control options you have for minimizing damage in future years if you can move the plant around. But that is one final part of scouting that needs to be thought about if you are going to try controlling the problem. And if you have any questions about whether or not something might be destructive to a plant or, you know, potentially deadly to a plant, that's always something you can call the extension office about.
Excellent. Well, I do appreciate you coming on, Jesse, and letting us know on all that good information. And I, of course, know that people can, yeah, like you said, call the extension office if they want to get a hold of you. And we appreciate you coming by and letting us know on this topic.
Yeah. I did have one event that I forgot to bring up at the beginning of the session. Tomorrow at 6 at Independence Public Library, as part of their Eat, Play, Read program, we are doing a class on foraging. The one topic that I get more class requests on than any other, it's been a very popular topic, is people are interested in having more of a say in where their food comes from. So if you are interested in foraging at all, learning how to forage, what plants to forage, and how to do it safely, that's going to be tomorrow at 6 at the Public Library in Independence.
Excellent. Well, we do appreciate you letting us know about that, and I look forward to talking again here real soon, Jesse.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay, you have a good one. That's Jesse Gilmore here, horticulture agent for K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And coming up, we are going to be having an early bird edition of Open Line just a couple of minutes away. That's coming up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.